If you love all things gardening, why not join us at our Spring Fair from the 3rd to the 5th of May at Bewley in Hampshire? You'll find everything you need to kickstart the season. Find out more at bbcgardenersworldfair.com. See you there.
At KPMG, our people make the difference. Combining the power of people and technology, we uncover brighter insights, innovate bolder solutions, and create better data-driven outcomes. KPMG, make the difference.
Hello and welcome to the BBC Gardeners World magazine podcast, brought to you by the team here at the magazine. Join us as we chat all things gardening with the nation's favourite experts.
Are you concerned by climate change, but wondering how to make a genuine difference? Do you worry that some conventional ways of gardening may do more harm than good to the environment? Hello, I'm Lucy, and I'm exploring how gardening sustainably enables us all to make a positive difference in tackling the effects of climate change. Joining us today as our guide is Arit Anderson, garden designer and presenter of Gardener's World, who's been passionate about championing sustainability in gardening since creating her pioneering show garden that highlighted these issues back in 2016. From nourishing our soil to creating compost, conserving water to choosing the right plants, Arit believes that gardening and good garden design benefits our environment, and that just a few small steps by all of us could bring positive change. So, I started by asking her, what is sustainable gardening?
Well, it feels so overwhelming, and it feels like it's a phrase that's used so much at the moment, but I kind of feel, in some ways, to kind of simplify it, sustainable gardening is about trying to make sure that you're not using resources or materials that you use now that might take from future generations. That's one aspect of it. And another way to think about it simplistically is to do no harm, to make sure that the materials, the plants, anything that you're bringing into your garden in the long term isn't harming any of the natural ecosystem that sits within your garden.
So that's a really big concept, kind of brought down to sort of really couple of lovely kind of bite-sized ideas to think about. I mean, sustainable gardening can be confusing for people, but I mean, I like to think about just the word at the heart of it, sustain. It kind of means nourish, and that's sort of what you've been saying about not taking away from future generations and in fact, maybe building towards that.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the whole thing about sustainability, it means that we should be able to be using things in our garden that naturally would be able to replenish themselves in the life cycle of a generation. So, I mean, you know, we've talked about pea and we know about water and all these other different things and oil. I know we don't, you know, oil, even when people are using petrol mowers, you know, that's a resource where they take thousands of years to kind of produce those natural things that we just can use in a beat of a heartbeat. So I think it's just kind of getting in tune with the fact that, am I doing something within my own space, my own garden, that has come from a resource that I will never ever know whether it's been replenishable or not, or that it's caused damage in the wider environment to get to me to have a convenient moment in my garden?
Look, take us back. Take us back to how you first got inspired by this notion of sustainable gardening. What kicked it off for you?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I'm definitely not come from a, you know, major gardening family and have not been around a lovely granny that's shown me things. But I've always enjoyed the natural environment. I was brought up in the green belt, if you like, of Hertfordshire. So I've always had sort of greener space to go out into. And so I've come into gardening later in life, as most people know. And, you know, I remember speaking to the wonderful John Brooks, and he was like, you know, what is it, girl? What is it that really gets you going? And at that point, it was, you know, things, I loved plants that had great adaptation, like Mediterranean plants that sit there baked in the sun within an inch of their life, and then they spring back. So I was beginning to get really interested in how plants kind of adapt and change and all their different little traits that they have. And so that was one thing. But really, I guess the turning point was doing a show garden in 2016. And that was focusing on, you know, renewable energies and that our gardens of the future may not be as they are now, and that we would need to use renewable energy now and stop basically draining oil out of our poor world as a result of that supplies us with, yes, fuel, but also plastic and all of those things. So really, I guess it was the show garden where I really kind of felt, you know, this is an area that is really, really key. And I guess even only in 2016, which is what, only 5 years ago, we wasn't using this terminology in our everyday language that we're using now. So, yeah, quite key.
I think it's really interesting, isn't it, that the last year or so, because we've been so close to our gardens, so many of us have really perhaps started to identify climate change as something that we can influence through our gardens, or at least, you know, see some issues around climate change just in our own back garden. So I get the sense that there's more and more interest in this than there's ever been. And I think a lot of that is, you know, a result of lockdown and a result of us just being a little bit closer to nature than we've been before.
Oh, 100%, 100%. I mean, you know, the lovely Sir David Attenborough, you know, happened to be a talk that he was at, and he really summed it up that if we want people to care about the world, for those of us that have a garden, it starts in our back garden, quite frankly. And that, like you say, because we had our world shut down to us, we couldn't go off and fly to sunny climes or any of that, that our world shrunk to our back garden. And therefore, all of a sudden, we realised that this little microcosm between our gates and our fences was something that we could be a part of and that we could actually influence. And that's been massively important over this past year.
And I think that's not going to go away. I think it started something that's just not going to stop.
Absolutely. Gardens are not just for pandemics. You know, they are so important to us. And people have realised that coming in, you know, coming in from a day's work. Sometimes, yeah, I remember one of the reasons when I got my garden, the garden that I have now, and I just thought I was working in a different industry at the time. Oh, I know, I'll come home with a glass of wine and our deadhead, and somebody else will hopefully do the gardening. And that was never going to be the case, because as soon as obviously I got the garden, I got just so obsessed, like so many of us do. And I think that people realise that within their garden, there's so many different things that you can do that you're not going to fail. The garden's not there to trip us up. It's there to teach us, to nourish us. You talked about nurturing earlier on, and the joy it gives us from not only what we visually see, maybe from what we taste if we grow our own, from what we smell, and also that unknown, can't put our finger on it, that healing feeling of just being good and feeling safe. It's a safe haven.
So we got the big idea there. So listen, why don't we plunge into the garden itself? Let's take us into our gardens, and let's take us through what sustainable gardening means in practical terms. Let's start by talking about plastics.
Yeah, plastics. Well, again, this is something that is what we have to remember. It's pretty recent. I mean, you know, you wanted to grow plants sort of anything sort of 50s and beforehand, you know. It would be using terracotta pots and growing things from cuttings. You know, we didn't have these lovely instant 2-litre, 5-litre plants that we can go around our nurseries and buy now. And plastic, you know, I know why people use it. You know, it's light. It's cheap in terms of in its manufacturer. If it's black, it helps to keep the roots really nice and dark, which is what they want. But obviously, it's very easy to start quickly accumulating a lot of plastic in our gardens. We go to the garden centre, we want to feel good. We go to the pollinator section. You know, we're thinking about our biodiversity, and we take our plant home and we pop our plant in the ground, and we're left with a piece of material that's going to be around for probably another 1,000 years in real terms. So there is a big issue about it. And, you know, I think us as gardeners, myself included, you know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that, you know, I've grown every single thing in my garden from seed. I really wish that I had been able to. But before I was like, oh, I don't really know what to do with all of these plastic pots. And now what it's done in these later years of understanding just the damage that it causes is that I don't have to buy every single plant. I can buy from seed. I can get cuttings, and I can reuse that plastic. That's one of the really key things, is to reuse what you've got rather than go out and buy more.
Mm. I think I've seen you say, you know, we should be very considered in the way that we actually buy our plants. And I guess it's just really, you know, talk us through that idea.
Yeah, well, it reiterates the fact that, you know, look, when we go out to the garden centre, we kind of get like kids, you know, we see all the sweets, the annuals and everything that's bouncing at us and all these flowers and lovely fragrances that are coming at us. And we kind of buy loads and loads of plants, and often we'll get back home. And yes, we might get them in the ground, but then we don't see them for another season. They're gone. And often that is because we haven't really done our homework and worked out what is the right plant that we should be buying. So we end up wasting it, really. And then we're left with that plastic pot. So, you know, of course, I would never want to take the joy of buying plants away from anybody. It just means that we just have to give a little bit more consideration about what it is we want to purchase. And maybe as well being a bit more confident to buy smaller as well, to buy a smaller plant in a smaller pot and watch that grow on. You know, we're a bit fixated about instant.
Yeah. And yet those big plants have very often had a lot of resource put into them in order to make them big and keep them big. So yeah, I guess you're looking at resources and how long it's been sitting on, you know, a forecourt or you know, or in a nursery bed.
Yeah.
No,
definitely.
But you're right, there's a lot of pleasure in growing something from small and from a small size. And of course, it's easier on the pocket as well.
Well, it's much easier on the pocket, and also as well that, you know, smaller plants, especially if you're putting them straight into your borders, once they get to a certain size, maybe like a 9 cm type size, and they're ready to go into the border, it kind of means that when they're smaller, their root system's smaller, that they can actually start to get more in tune with the environment. So the roots start to kind of get to really take in the nutrients that are in your soil, the microbiology, which also is really key, the water levels that are there. So the longer you leave your plants in containered pots before you put them in, they're in this very false environment that's been fed with fertilizers and gets watered all the time. But when they're in the ground, it makes them more resilient. And that's what we're looking for in plants. We're looking to make sure that they are very resilient, sentient beings. And we need to make sure that resilience stays. And buying smaller is part of that process.
It's absolutely the case with trees, isn't it? You know, never plant anything taller than you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, obviously there are instances and there are gardens that do that. And you know, as you said, whether it's been grown in your garden or grown in a nursery. But you know, if budget is difficult, and budget is one thing, there's always the cost, the cash cost, but there's also time. You've got to marry that up with time, because what you save in your pocket by buying smaller, what you gain in time is watching that plant or that tree come into fruition of its own. And you've been part of that process rather than sometimes the instant garden that can appear, that can be very like, da-da, big reveal. And it's almost like, oh, where does that come from? So, you know, in the garden, definitely make sure that there's a nice balance of having things that you've been able to grow, if you can grow your own or buy smaller, and enjoy that process of it growing up.
Well, that's right. And that whole process of gardening, not just the end result, has been shown to be so important to us, actually, in our well-being. It's actually being a part of the process and enjoying the activity of gardening. That's as good for us, isn't it? You know, in terms of our,
definitely,
you know, in terms of how we're feeling, our mood, or, you know, call it mindfulness or well-being or wellness, that's a really big, big benefit. But I wanted to talk about peat, because obviously this year, you know, you've been really exploring, last year and this year, you've been exploring the issues around peat, and it's really come to the fore lately as certainly in the UK, we're looking at how do we phase out peat from horticulture. So talk to us about what a sustainable garden, you know, how that relates to peat, and what's happening about peat.
I think what's been interesting since going through with the GW team, you know, the research and then the programme, which is now out there, and hearing feedback from viewers as well. A lot of people didn't really connect to the fact that peatlands are actually their own ecosystem. and the fact that it is a huge carbon store. It is the planet's natural carbon storage, i.e. it keeps carbon in the ground as opposed to being up in the atmosphere where we've got the issue, which creates a greenhouse gas effect. So I think that was one of the key things when we did the first piece on it, was to really give people the context of what a peatland is. So so there is the carbon side of it, the carbon issue, the carbon being that it sucks carbon out of the atmosphere and keeps it in the ground, but also that it is a actual ecosystem of itself. It's quite interesting that if you look at a peatland, hardly any of our garden plants would survive in a true peatland environment. Okay, it's too wet, there's not enough nutrients, it's quite anaerobic, it's quite a kind of harsh environment in some ways, but it's because people are attracted to it, because it has the peat has this inert quality to it, i.e. that it holds water, and that it, when you add certain nutrients to it, it means that when you use it as a medium in our garden plants, it's great because it can keep plants going until they get into the ground, if you like. So I think what was really interesting was that people didn't realise that we are quite literally destroying a habitat. It's the same situation as the rainforest. You know, we are literally scraping out this substance, this natural product that takes 1,000 years, Lucy, to lay down 1 meter of peat. And whichever way you look at it, that is not sustainable. We're not around for 1,000 years. You know, even if 5 generations isn't around for 1,000 years, and we taken it out at a rate that is quicker than what it can be replenished. And that's the questioning that we're asking people to think about. You know, people need to have an informed choice. And once you know something, you can't unknow it. But whether you make a choice as to crack on and carry on with peat, or whether you kind of say, I'm going to reduce the peat I use or not use any peat, that really is down to us as gardeners to make a choice about.
And it's been relatively difficult until just the last few years to find a wide selection of peat-free compost. But that is changing now. So people have got options.
Yes, that is changing. And I do know that people were very concerned in terms of when this transition, and it's been on the go for quite some time, the peat debate. A lot of this has come about whereby it's convenient for us, the amount of plant material that we're now obsessed with, which is great. You know, you've got to say to yourself, would you be prepared to take a less plump plant and live with it a little bit longer to nurture it on and to get it into the ground?
And almost in a way, you know, lockdown last year, when we couldn't get hold of compost easily, did introduce lots of people to the idea of kind of make do with what you've got and reuse compost from pots and also use your garden soil. And I think in a way we've become attuned to growing things in a medium that comes from a bag rather than looking at our gardens and thinking, well, actually, the garden's a source as well. So
this weekend, for example, we're out in the garden. We've got containerized potatoes. We haven't got huge amounts of space. And, you know, when you want to put the little second layer of compost in there, soil in there, just for the extra growth. And, yeah, we were robbing out of the other containers, which I'd had for bulbs, et cetera, and just enriching them a little bit. Again, putting a bit of biochar in and a tiny little bit of organic fertilizer. And that's fine. I think we have to remember that soil and compost, they it's more than just the nutrient given. It's there to also hold roots and to actually be a support for the plants.
And that's, I guess, really fundamental to the sustainable garden, is this notion of conserving, using and then reusing what you have. You know, whether it's through composting, you know, saving seeds, taking cuttings, and obviously in this instance, using a resource that, you know, that we've used maybe last year and it's still there and available for us. So this whole notion, let's sort of kind of talk about, you know, how we reuse some things, what else we could be doing to use and reuse what we've got in our gardens.
Every piece of plant material that's in our garden is a way of being compost for us. So, you know, it's like sweeping up the leaves. I know that, you know, leaf mold is the new gold. You know, it is, well, it's the old gold. It's always been like gold. Sweeping up your leaves, taking your cuttings. You don't have to have a great big compost bin. Sometimes even just being able to put some things down in a bag, aerate the bag, let it break down a little bit, and then be able to put that back onto your borders. It's free. And it's come from your plants feeding the next plants. At the heart of a lot of this is time and getting a better relationship to time, having the time to do the research, taking a bit more time to go out and see whether you can maybe go and get your peat-free compost from someone else, taking a bit more time to experiment on composting, have a go at doing the cuttings.
Time is such an interesting idea, that like we're giving ourselves more time with our gardens and enjoying it. And I think through that, I know you've talked about observation as well, yeah, and just being alert and aware, which I guess brings us on to the next issue, which a lot of people say, OK, it's all very well to sort of, you know, take your own cuttings, raise your own seeds and so on and so on. But what happens when the pests and diseases kick in? What's the sustainable way of keeping a healthy garden?
I mean, a healthy garden, in its truest form, is one where you let the natural cycle of predation come through, the natural biology to be able to work its way through the garden. And I think it's a case of, you know, of course, even in wider environments, you know, we do get diseases that can kind of be prevalent. But if you think about some of our big diseases that are going on at the moment, like ash dieback or oak processionary moth, they are things that have come in to our environment from elsewhere in the world, where elsewhere in the world, their natural system can cope. So we have to remember that our gardens is a controlled environment. Okay, so we are tweaking how we're putting plants together, and you know, and manipulating the space for ourselves, which is great. That's the joy of it. But one of the things that we can sometimes forget is to allow our plants to become more resilient. You know, sometimes I think I'm a bit mean, if you like, with some of the plants. Now at the minute, I'm waiting to kind of do some work on my garden. So maybe rightly or wrongly, I've had that luxury of just going, oh, well, go on, roses, you enjoy yourselves. I'm not going to cut you back. Just do what you want to, because I might move you in a couple of seasons time, whatever. But what's happened in that process of letting things go, inverted commas, what I mean by that is that I've not been on top of everything all the time, spraying, cleaning, pinching out, in terms of, you know, taking off every single last bug. So I'll give you a great example. So last summer, you know, as we just went into lockdown, it was sort of early on, and I go out in the garden and I'm like, hey, Harvey, come and have a look. It's my stepson. And the Daphne Adora, which I've had in this garden pretty much since I've been here, day one, was just covered in aphids, covered. And to the point where it was actually starting to defoliate the plant. It just kind of felt like it had come from nowhere. And I was like, oh, how on earth could I have missed seeing this amount of aphids? Anyway, so we started off with a little bit of just getting to give him some fun, because, you know, after he's done his work, his schoolwork, he'd get his little water spray out and he was spraying them off, because, you know, just and picking them off and getting involved that way. But they were clearly an issue. But then over the course of the next couple of weeks, in come the sparrows, and the sparrows got involved, and I kept seeing them in the rose bush, which is next near to the Daphne. And before you know it, they'd cleaned up. And, you know, and that's what I mean in terms of patience, observation, and allowing nature to come in and to therefore feed those sparrows. Feeding the birds a little bit less meant they had to go and have a look else what else was going on in the garden. So we do like to feed the birds, but I was just saying, just a couple of handfuls less, because we need them aphids sorted out.
So then that's really about having the confidence to know it's going to happen. And it does happen.
It does.
You know, you've had the living example of it.
Yeah. And it can take time. I think a lot of the time we're impatient, you know, and so we kind of feel that, oh, well, if we spray everything, then that will kind of, you know, that gets rid of one problem. But what it does is it creates an imbalance elsewhere within the garden. And that's the thing that we've got to kind of allow. And this is part of the wider issue with the sort of bugs that we're losing. You know, we've got a massive extinction issue with insect life on this planet, I mean, which we might be squeamish about a spider, or, you know, we might not like the way that slugs and snails are in our garden, but they all have a place in the order of life. So I think it'd be really helpful if we can just sort of get a bit more in tune with that and put the bug spray down and observe a little bit more. And if you do get little issues, you know, what's the other natural alternative that I can use? So if, for example, those aphids had gotten really way out of control, I was nearly on the precipice of having to kind of buy in some ladybirds, because we found one ladybird in the garden. And of course, if I'd have been spraying, I'd have killed that as well. Mm. I'd have killed the predators as well as what's being called as a nuisance.
So yes, yeah, so biocontrols are a new, relatively recent sort of friend to the home gardener, but such a successful one and kind of easy to get hold of and so on, even easier than ever. So, and there's companion planting that you can do to attract, you know, to both repel things you maybe don't want and also to attract in.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. I mean, I just think of it like this, Lucy. You know, we're providing dinner. At the end of the day, whatever way you look at it, you've just put out a gourmet meal, your hostas and, you know, the roses and all of these things. And then we're kind of saying, nobody can come into the party. You know, that's like you or I having this gorgeous sort of like banquet of food. And then somebody's saying, stop, don't eat. That's just not going to happen. You're going to get tucked in. So, you know, we have to think about how do we make sure that there's a balance. And maybe there are a few sacrificial hostas, you know, that will save another plant, like the companion planting that you were talking about. And, you know, your garden, you want it to look good, but it doesn't have to be a show garden. It looks natural if there's a few bites out of those leaves, because it means that you've got your friends have come for dinner, and that's fine. And there's another little phrase that I like to think about, especially when I'm talking to clients, you know, I know that you're the paying client, but there are many clients coming through this garden that we have to think about. And they're like, oh, and I'm like, yes. So, you know, think of it as you're sharing that garden. You're a custodian. You've got other beings that need to come through as well.
That's a great thought. That really is a great thought. But and you sort of lead us naturally on to obviously you're with your professional hat on. What does it mean that we need to think about in design terms?
Well, I think for me, I mean, I think there's a lot about, you know, one of the key principles about garden design is simplicity in design. It's one of sort of seven principles, and simplicity is one of them. And I think that when I was at college, that simplicity was about, you know, not over designing and putting loads of different layers and levels and showing off with what you can do. But I think the simplicity isn't just about that the simplicity comes back to the basics and the basics of that space. And that means that we as designers and landscape architects, that we have to be a lot more in tune with the base unit. And the base unit is the soil and the land itself. What have we got? What is in front of us? What does this want to be? A very dear friend of mine and colleague, Marion Boswell, she, I love the term she always uses, which is, what would this land want to be if I wasn't here? Would it want water on it? You know, would it want to be a woodland? You know, really getting a sense of the space. And I think the soil is something really what I'm learning more and more and more every single day, the importance of our soil, that it's a living organism in itself. It's not just a bit of dirt that kind of gets our feet dirty or gets traipsed in the house. You know, it actually holds all life. And without that soil, we wouldn't be here. So that's something that I'm, you know, very conscious of and try now as best I can. Obviously, I have to work with a client need as well. I'm not going to deny that. But really thinking about how much of that soil can I turn over to soft landscape, for example. How much of that, how much more plant material can be brought into a space? Because design isn't just about the patio and the fences and the outdoor kitchen. You know, the design is very much obviously the plants. They're the heroes in any garden. And as a designer, the classic thing to be asked would be, I want this, I want that, I want year-round colour, and I want it to look amazing, and I also want it to be low maintenance. And that was already a tussle. It's like, you can't have all those things and then decide that you never want a garden in your garden. You know, that's really difficult. Every garden needs levels of care and development are my key words. I don't like to use the word maintenance. It makes it feel very static. You might maintain a fence, but you certainly don't maintain plants. You want to develop them and grow with them. So I think that people now are realizing and understanding the joy, the benefit that the plant material brings to the garden, and that actually there was a time when, yes, of course, you know, using very dominant patio sizes and the new porcelain that came in, because porcelain was the wonder material that you just wash it down and it just never ever stains, etc., etc. And that was almost a way of statementing, look at my garden, look at how maybe how much money I've got or how much design prowess that I've got. Whereas I think now people expect and want to see a lot more, as we use the term a lot, much more naturalistic and much more softer feeling. So that doesn't mean to say it hasn't got to be designed. It doesn't mean to say that your border still can't be mixed with some amazing exotics and non-natives. I'll come back onto that one. But certainly the greenery is really, I think, becoming more and more key in people's gardens. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess it's also made us aware, I think, and I know you're passionate about the role for trees in a garden.
Yes, trees. I mean, I'm looking at my garden as I'm talking to you, I'm looking out the window, Lucy, and when I first arrived and I was pretty new to gardening, I'd say proper new to gardening. And I remember there's this big eucalyptus at the end of the garden, and I only have a small garden. It's only about, and it's longest about 15 meters really long and 4.5-5 meters wide. So it's a small town garden, and there's this ginormous eucalyptus there. And at the time I thought, oh God, that's big. And, you know, even then I knew that was not quite the right plant in the right place. I've left the tree, and it's had to be crowned and thinned. But very interestingly, when I had somebody round a couple of weeks ago to start to thin out this tree, because it had gotten a bit wayward, as eucalyptus does, all the neighbours around the outside, they thought I was having it brought down. I had some guy come round, all knocking on the door, you taking that tree down? And my other neighbour, oh, no, Harry, I don't want you to take that limb off. And all of a sudden you realise that tree doesn't, it's just because it's physically in my garden, it serves a purpose to all the other houses around it. It's screened, birds come and sit in it, you know, offers shade as well. So that tree all of a sudden has got a multi-purpose. And I think that people are nervous about trees. They worry about roots is a classic one. You know, are there going to be roots that are going to come and up, you know, upturn my patio and my house? And again, get some expert advice on that if you're really worried. It's about the choice of tree that you would have and how close that you plant it near to your house. Trees in your garden are just wonderful. And what it does is it creates its own microclimate. So when we have those really hot days, the shading that we get and the coolness, because obviously in the breeze, you get extra breeze from those leaves as well. The birds love it. We have got the most amount of trees in our garden on my run because I live on a terrace. And I watch the birds go from the eucalyptus down to the pittosporum. They hit the acer. They then come down into the shrub layer and then they come into the little covered way. And those trees in the garden are not just visually great for me. They actually are acting as food, shelter, shade, cooling, you name it. It's got the multifunctional trees have got a multifunctional service that they can give us in our garden. So yes, as you can probably tell, I'm very, very passionate about trees being in people's gardens.
Do you think every garden's got room for a tree?
Oh, I think so. There's a tree, you know, there's a tree out there, or large shrub, whichever you want to call it, that's out there for everybody. Because, you know, certainly like in a south-facing garden, you know, the best thing that you're ever going to bring into a garden for when it's relentless heat, you know, south-facing feels fabulous, but you sometimes just need to get out of that sun. And, you know, and you can go and walk under a tree and almost get, you know, nearly a 10 centigrade degree difference in temperature within a space. And I think what we have to remember is this, you know, our population is growing. We have an urban sprawl. We are sprawling into our countryside, and therefore we are pushing nature further and further out to a boundary. You know, people may have heard about urban forests trying to bring a lot more tree material into our urban cities, because not only is it good for wildlife, it is good for us. And that's really important.
Mm. Well, now I wanted to talk about the choice of plants as well. Right plant, right place is obviously something that, you know, a sort of mantra that that everyone talks about. But talk us through the choice of plants, because in a sustainable garden, you know, and I think you touched on it earlier, the notion of exotics. Is there a place for that? Should we be just thinking about native plants? You know, what is the garden of the future sort of, you know, well, the next, certainly, you know, 10, 20, next generation or so, what does it look like? You know, what, because... are we going back on all of that kind of Victorian plant hunting, try something new? Should we be rethinking the future of plant choices?
Well, it's really interesting that you bring this up, because, you know, at science level, this debate goes on and on, you know, in terms of whether or not there's space for exotics, i.e. those plants that don't necessarily live in our natural environment. And it's a debate that I'm always really keen to listen to, because you learn so much from it, really. But again, let's keep it simple, because there is a huge science about whether people believe it in it or not. But by keeping it simple, our borders, we are trying to ensure that we are providing shelter, food, as much kind of carbon capture into our borders as we can. And some of that wouldn't necessarily just come from our natives. Obviously, over time now, within the UK, because of the amount of land that we've given over to agriculture, because, as you say, those Victorians have been around bringing plants into our gardens, that actually there's probably a lot of plants in there that we think are native and actually have come from a very far-flung place. But we're so used to seeing them within our gardens that really that those mixed borders can be quite rich in terms of how they can feed the wildlife in our country. Now, I know that on the Gardeners World magazine website, I mean, I know that you're very good at putting an indication as to whether or not a plant does provide for wildlife, or I know you also indicate whether it's toxic and all of that type of thing. Go out into your garden and do an audit. Have I chosen everything, for example, to be so evergreen, doesn't produce any flower or anything at all that can help our own wildlife? And what value does that give? Of course, it might mean, well, I've only got to go out there once or twice a year to trim everything. But we've got to think about the other values that those plants bring to the party, quite frankly. And it could even be, even, you know, the basics, you know, our own, for us, have a fruit tree. Going back to the tree thing, you know, things that can provide us with fruits, let alone, you know, the birds and all the pollinators and all the other insects. So I think that really it's a debate that people should be listening to. There are, I can hear different voices shouting at me as I'm talking, go, no, Ari, it's, you know, it's about the natives. And I definitely know that there are very eminent people that I respect that actually encourage that we have a species rich border, as long as it's rich and it's diverse. It's when it becomes very monocultured that it becomes much more narrow and difficult to feed the garden, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and if you take it back to what's truly native, if we can ever get back to that stage, you know, UK plant, native plant life, as it were, is relatively limited. And actually, we can bring all sorts of things in. I know the RHS have done trials and shown that, you know, wildlife can't necessarily always read that label.
No.
And they'll go happily to those lovely open plants that you know, that's got great for pollen or whatever. So,
yeah,
I think that's really the sort of key to it, isn't it?
It is,
diversity and so much. And I think the one thing before we sort of wrap up, one thing we haven't yet talked about is water. How as a designer, do you sort of look at a garden and think, how do I bring more water in, whether it's for ornamental, decorative, conservation, storage?
If we think about water and try to think about the conservation of water and try to think about water as a very precious commodity, which is what it is, because I think that because we're very lucky in the West and certainly in the UK, we turn on a tap and we expect water to come out of it. And we get very upset in those drought moments when we can't. Water is something that we all have the opportunity to really treat as something a lot more precious than what we do. We're very lucky in the UK in particular. We can turn on a tap and we have water, you know, just there. It just always feels like it's always there. Even the fact that this year alone, you know, the first couple of months, we haven't had any rain. It was really cold, but there was no rain. So immediately, you know, they were kind of, that's headed into sort of drought conditions. And then what's happening in the world because of climate change, we'll then get a deluge of water and we can't actually then cope with it. Our systems don't cope with it. A lot gets lost in the drains where people are paving over a lot more surfaces. It's just water runoff. So I think within a sustainable garden, if you can capture your own water, using water butts would be great. If you're really inclined, you know, rain gardens, create a rain garden so that every aspect of water actually feeds back into the actual garden itself. But and making sure that in those hot periods, you know, have you mulched everything as best you can and put a mulch layer on that stops water evaporating? When to use water? Often, people sort of say, you know, when's the best time? And I spoke to Janet Manning, and she is a water expert, and she's passionate about water clearly. And for her, it's in the morning, because I was really upset when she said that to me, because I was like, well, I enjoyed being able to water with my gin and tonic or a glass of wine in the evening. Didn't feel quite as appealing with a cup of tea in the morning. So watering in the morning is good. But obviously, if you can't, then again, wait for the sun to go down. Don't waste it by just spraying the whole plant. Really think about where you're aiming that water to soak the root ball. And you're better off to water plants, soak them every couple of days rather than a little bit all the time, because otherwise the plant just puts up roots that just want to sit at the top of the plant and they don't really put their roots down. And just to kind of think about this, that watering our gardens for an hour, you know, really got that hose on, you know, that can be the same amount of water of a family of four uses in a day. So that's quite a lot of water. So we've really got to think about how we can minimise the water and capture as much as we can in the rain, and think about plants that are either adapted for more drought area if you live in a drier part of the country, or use boggy plants to take up water if you sometimes, unfortunately, sit in a part of the country that has a lot of water.
If we all just took one step to get started on this, what do you think it should be?
If I was being really honest, it's to take more time, because time is behind everything that we do in terms of running a sustainable garden. Having the time to grow plants from seed, grow our own plants, for example, having the time to make compost, if we can make compost, having the time to water carefully, should we need to water, our choice of plants, taking our time at the garden centre, making sure that we've chosen the right plants, taking the time to do the research. Because if we can take time to do those things, then the choices that we make in our garden will make a difference. And I think that's the thing. It's getting a better relationship with time, because often convenience is what is quite literally costing us the earth.
Thanks for listening to the BBC Gardeners World magazine podcast. And for more gardening tips and inspiration, why not try our new magazine subscription offer for podcast listeners at buysubscriptions.com/GWpod. You'll also find our special offer in the podcast pages on gardenersworld.com, where we also share more about today's themes. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please tell others about it and rate us in your podcast provider app. And we'll see you next time.